From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue tried to stop abortions in seven cities across the United States. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the group's founder, Randall Terry, about last week's campaign and the rest of his agenda for a Christian nation. Then we'll talk to Diane Strauss, the director of a group of clinics targeted by Operation Rescue. Several years ago, her home was picketed by anti-abortion protesters. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Exile in Guyville, the debut album by Liz Phair, inspired by a Rolling Stones album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton's compromise plan to allow homosexuals in the military won important support today from the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator Sam Nunn opened hearings on the plan today by saying that he hopes the panel will hear testimony that will enable it to write the president's plan into law. Nunn's been one of the most powerful opponents of President Clinton's campaign promise to lift the ban on homosexuals completely. Strom Thurmond, the senior Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, said today that he thought the president's plan was workable. He added, however, that there might be a problem with a provision that would allow homosexuals to state their orientation and still remain in the service. President Clinton has named U.S. District Judge Louis Freeh to be the new head of the FBI. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton called the 43-year-old New York judge a law enforcement legend. Freeh has spent his entire career in public service. He became an FBI agent right out of law school, then went on to become a federal prosecutor. He coordinated the Justice Department's investigation into the letter bombing that killed 11th Circuit Court Judge Robert Vance, and he led the prosecution team that broke up the mafia drug ring known as the Pizza Connection. White House spokesman Dee Dee Myers says Freeh should have no trouble being confirmed because he went through a similar confirmation process 2 years ago when President Bush appointed him to the federal bench. Freeh replaces Judge William Sessions, who was appointed to head the FBI by Ronald Reagan in 1987. He was fired by President Clinton yesterday after he had been accused of ethical improprieties, charges that he denied. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
A long-awaited report on riots 2 years ago in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn blames the city's mayor and police commissioner for the failure to mobilize a stronger police response. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports.
The 600-page report commissioned by Governor Mario Cuomo and released by the state's criminal justice director concludes that top-ranking police brass were slow to change from a policy of restraint to more aggressive tactics to deal with racial disturbances between blacks and Jews in Crown Heights during 4 nights of rioting. The violence erupted after a black child was accidentally struck and killed by a car in a Lubavitcher motorcade. Later that night, a Jewish scholar was stabbed to death in apparent retaliation, allegedly by black youths. One person was tried for the crime and acquitted. A copy of the report has been sent to Attorney General Janet Reno to help with an ongoing federal investigation. The report exonerates Mayor David Dinkins from the charges leveled by some critics that he ordered the police to hold back. But it says he was slow to demand a police crackdown to put an end to the street violence. Crown Heights has been a major issue in the early mayoral campaign between Dinkins and likely Republican rival Rudolph Giuliani, a former U.S. attorney. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
The Dow Industrials gained 9.5 points today. This is NPR. Emergency officials in St. Louis are bracing for another higher crest of the Mississippi River. The National Weather Service is predicting that the new crest will only be about an inch higher than the record 46.9 crest on Sunday night. Hydrologists say the danger could be far greater because the levees have already been weakened by days of high waters. Justice officials in Germany say convicted terrorist Abbas Hamadi will be paroled and expelled to Lebanon. Hamadi is serving a 13-year prison term for hostage-taking. Deidre Berger reports.
Abbas Hamadi will be deported to Lebanon in early August after serving half of his prison sentence, according to the federal prosecutor's office. German law allows the early deportation of foreigners serving prison sentences. Hamadi is serving a 13-year sentence. He was convicted by a German court on charges of kidnapping and the possession of explosives. Hamadi's brother, Mohammed, who was convicted of hijacking a TWA jet in 1985 and killing a U.S. Navy diver on board the flight, is serving a life sentence in a German jail. Bonn officials repeatedly denied rumors after the release of several German hostages in Lebanon. They had secretly agreed to the early release of the Hamadi brothers, but the two were placed in the same prison in Saarbrücken, Germany, after the release of the last two German hostages in Lebanon. Mohammed Hamadi this week was transferred back to the Frankfurt jail, where he began serving his sentence. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
Fans were evacuated from the Atlanta Fulton County Stadium in Atlanta today after a fire broke out near the press box behind home plate. The fire broke out about 90 minutes before a game between the Atlanta Braves and the St. Louis Cardinals. Two firefighters were reportedly treated for minor injuries. The fire was described as intense and fast-moving, sweeping through some of the stadium's luxury boxes. It's now reported to be almost out. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Operation Rescue, the militant anti-abortion group, has concluded its seven-city, week-and-a-half-long campaign called Cities of Refuge. They targeted clinics in Philadelphia, Cleveland, Minneapolis, Dallas-Fort Worth, San Jose, Melbourne, and Jackson. Operation Rescue claimed success, but so did abortion rights groups, which were able to keep most clinics open. At many of the demonstrations, there were far fewer anti-abortion activists than expected. We're going to hear from Randall Terry, the founder of Operation Rescue. Randall Terry organized Operation Rescue in 1986 in Binghamton, New York, where he lives. After being arrested at protests dozens of times, he wrote his new book, Why Does a Nice Guy Like Me Keep Getting Thrown in Jail? Earlier today, we spoke with him from a studio in Binghamton, where he hosts a Christian radio show. In the second part of our program, we'll speak to the director of several private clinics in Philadelphia and New Jersey. I asked Randall Terry if he wanted to close down the clinics in Philadelphia and New Jersey.
Let me make this clear. We want all abortion mills to revert to the practice of medicine. An abortion mill is an abominable place where innocent children are killed and vulnerable women are maimed both emotionally and physically for life. So obviously we think they're from the pit and we want them to return to the practice of medicine.
I ask that because the Philadelphia, with the exception of one suburban clinic in Philadelphia and Jersey, the clinics were not shut down.
Yes, well, the Philadelphia abortion mills have a longer history with the pro-life movement. They're a little bit more dug in, so they were more defiant. But there's no doubt in our minds that the number of children killed in the Philadelphia area were down in numbers, just like they were all over the country.
Would it be fair to say that recently Operation Rescue has been targeting individual doctors and medical workers, you know, picketing their homes? Would you describe that as a fairly recent tactic?
It's recent in the sense of about 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
We determined over 2 years ago that the child killer himself, the abortionist, the physician, that they are the weak link. And let's face it, a man goes to medical school, a woman goes to medical school for all those years. He wants to be respected in his community. He doesn't want to be seen as a murderer who's paying for his nice house with blood money. So when we go into a neighborhood, say, and do residential picketing, which is perfectly constitutional under Frisbee v. Schultz, we're exposing these abortionists, and many of them quit. They say, look, I don't want this bad publicity. I don't want my neighbors to think of me as an abortionist. So they bow out and they return to the practice of medicine. This has worked for literally scores of abortionists around the country, and we're going to keep using the tactic.
Well, some of them quit out of fear because they feel that their lives are in jeopardy or that their children are being harassed.
Well, first of all, for them to say they feel their lives are in jeopardy, I think is either a lie or it's the delusion that is brought on someone who kills for a living. I mean, paranoia is a real state of mind, even if the thing that someone is afraid of isn't real. So I have no doubt that some of these doctors are paranoid, but the reason they're paranoid is because they are haunted by their own conscience. They know that they have murdered for a living, and they're afraid that someone is going to take their life. Although, obviously, the pro-life movement, with the horrifying exception of David Gunn, the pro-life movement is a movement of nonviolence.
Well, you're saying these people are paranoid, but as you mentioned, David Gunn was murdered just a few months ago because he performed abortions.
And, that's correct, but
just one more thing, that many of the medical workers who are getting personally harassed are getting phone calls threatening their lives or threatening the lives of their children. I mean, that could be a very frightening thing. Do you?
I absolutely reject those tactics. I don't doubt that there are some fringe people that do them, Terry, but I cannot control every person in the world. Just like there are elements in the pro-abortion movement who have beaten pro-lifers many times. We have film of pro-lifers being punched in the face, kicked in the face, spit on, bitten by pro-abortion activists, many of whom are homosexuals, and yet the violence against us, of course, is not getting national media attention because we're not politically correct and because the media, by and large, just doesn't side with us. So we deplore this kind of violence on both sides, and frankly, their side has been 10 times as violent as our side.
Randall Terry, you have a new book called Why Does a Nice Guy Like Me Keep Getting Thrown in Jail? And in the book, you make it clear that abortion is just one component of your struggle. You write, "Let me say it clearly, we want a Christian nation. There are only two sides, those who hold their ethical allegiance to the Ten Commandments and those who don't. The question is, whose God and whose God's law will dominate this culture?" Where would you fit abortion in your kind of larger menu of issues?
Well, abortion is murder. And up until the late 60s, abortion was a criminal act in this country, punishable by fine and imprisonment, as well it should be. Let me make one thing clear, Terry. When I talk about a Christian nation, I'm not saying that by law everyone must be a Christian or go to church or take communion or anything like that. What I'm saying is that our ethical foundation for our cultural norms and our civic laws must be the Judeo-Christian ethics of the Bible, the Ten Commandments. Don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't perjure, honor your mother and father, don't blaspheme. These are the commandments upon which a civilized society must be built. Because if we don't have those things, then we're going to have the Ted Kennedys and the Barney Franks and the Bob Packwoods and the Bills and the Hillarys leading our nation into moral anarchy and ultimately destruction.
So let me ask you what your goals are besides outlawing abortion.
You pick the arena. Schooling, we would want parents to be able to have the right to choose where to put their kids. We want Planned Parenthood to be completely obliterated, them and their homosexual recruiting friends. We don't want kids having condoms distributed in school. We want children to be taught abstinence before marriage and fidelity afterwards. Homosexuals will get no special privileges, but the perverse acts of sex between men and men or women and women will continue to be criminal offenses. We will not have the messianic state funding every little person who whines that they have a special need or a special interest. People will be required to provide for their own, and it'll be the churches and the communities that help people who are in need, not the government. We won't continue to bail out every bad business decision, like the banks, because it only promotes more irresponsibility in business. In other words, let me cut right to the chase. We believe there's one Savior. His name is Jesus Christ. It is not Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam is not the great Savior, the great healer, the great deliverer, the great food producer. We want individual freedoms. We want the government to stay out of our lives, except that we want the government to prohibit acts of wickedness. That's the primary purpose for government is to raise up defense, build roads, and to punish wickedness. Wickedness defined by don't murder, don't rape, don't steal, don't molest children, etc.
Are there any acts of wickedness not already covered by the law that you think should be outlawed?
Well, it depends. You're talking about today? I mean, obviously, homosexuality in half of our states is illegal, and the other half it's not. Abortion, unfortunately, is legal in all 50 states. So there's obviously certain areas where we want to go back to. We want a nation that fears and honors God. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that's the kind of nation that George Washington and John Adams and Abraham Lincoln envisioned. These men quoted the Bible more than half of the preachers of our day. George Washington said it is impossible to rightly govern in this world without God and the Bible. He believed that religion and morality were the pillars upon which this republic was built, not the Constitution.
Let me ask you, in your view of a Christian nation, would there be birth control?
Well, if we're talking about the pill or the IUD, absolutely not, because those are abortifacients. The pill should have been outlawed a long time ago because of its link with cervical cancer, uterine cancer, breast cancer, and complications in little girls that were born. If you are talking about two adults involved in using a condom, then that's up to them.
Okay. Now, is this a shift in priorities for you? Has it always been this whole menu of ideas for you, or did your interest in stopping abortion come first?
Well, it kind of developed at the same time, Terry.
I guess, let me just stop you here. I'm asking also in terms of Operation Rescue. I mean, do you think that everybody in Operation Rescue shares the priorities that you're discussing?
Most of them, yes. In fact, the original vision of Operation Rescue was comprehensive. We wanted to use the rescue movement as a springboard for cultural reformation on a far broader spectrum. In other words, if we can produce the manpower and the momentum to outlaw child killing, we will then have the momentum and the manpower to outlaw pornography, to take the public education arena out of the hands of a pagan elite and restore it to parents in the community. It's an issue of getting the God-fearing community, the Christian community, out of its pews, out of its apathy, and into the cultural arena, the cultural battlefields of our day.
You have been saying that the floods that have devastated so much of America were God's judgment, God's wrath, because
yes.
of the abortions that are being performed. Why do you think God singled out those people who live on the banks of the rivers that have flooded?
Well, I think that it's just the first call, Terry. I think this is the first blast of the trumpet. We are going to see this country enter into the next millennium in convulsions. Our cities are going to be ravaged. What we saw in Los Angeles is just the beginning. We are going to have more and more severe weather patterns hit us. We're going to see an economic collapse that is going to produce mayhem for millions of people unless we repent. The bottom line is there are 30 million children who have been killed, and their blood right now is crying out from the ground for vengeance to Almighty God. And God is slow to wrath, but once he begins to move in judgment, he won't relent. And I can tell you that God has 100 hurricanes and 100 droughts and 100 floods and 100 terrorists at his disposal. I believe even that the recent beginning stages of terrorism against our nation are the judgment of God against us. It's like God saying, okay, look, you want to terrorize babies in the womb? I'm going to let you taste what terrorism really feels like.
When you say that the floods are a result of God's wrath because of abortion, does that mean that the people who are suffering in the floods now are more responsible for abortions being performed, or are they just getting an unlucky break here?
This is the horrifying nature of sin and judgment. For example, if a man commits adultery and leaves his wife becomes destitute, his children grow up fatherless, they suffer because of his sin. And the bottom line is, sometimes when God judges a nation, innocent people who are not guilty of the sin that brought the judgment suffer, which should make us not mad at God, but should make us mad at the people who have brought the judgment on us. When Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed by fire, there were little kids who were destroyed, but it was the raving homosexuals that brought the judgment down.
So the people who are flooded out now are suffering for the sins of the abortionists.
For the sins of the child killers, for the sins of the homosexuals, and for a plethora of areas where we are in rebellion to God. I mean, let's face it, all of us tolerate in our communities theaters that show the abuse of women and children. We tolerated the movie The Last Temptation of Christ, which blasphemed the Son of God. We're a country that has grown tolerant of wickedness and actually revels in things that are in rebellion to God. So really, what's shocking is not that God would bring judgment on the Mississippi riverbed. What's shocking is that he hasn't obliterated the whole country yet. Let's just hope that we wake up before he chooses to do that.
My guest is Randall Terry. He's the founder of Operation Rescue, and he's written a new book called Why Does a Nice Guy Like Me Keep Getting Thrown in Jail? We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Randall Terry, founder of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue. You come from a really interesting, paradoxical background. I mean, you have three aunts who are not only feminists but have been involved in the birth control movement. And from what I've read, your mother and your three aunts each had pregnancies out of wedlock when they were teenagers.
Yeah, I'm the pregnancy that my mom had.
Right. You're the pregnancy that she had out of wedlock.
Well, I was conceived out of wedlock, but my dad and her ended up getting married. And I could have been a prime target for abortion, had abortion been legal.
Is that one of the reasons why you became an activist, thinking about that, thinking that if abortion were legal, maybe you wouldn't be alive?
No, that's not one of the reasons why I became an activist. It never really occurred to me until a few years ago. But nevertheless, that is true. I could have been a victim. My mom and dad say, no, absolutely not. We would have gotten married. But I've been around too long. I've seen too many young people who at first, when they find out they're pregnant, say, well, let's get married. And then the pressure begins. Then the in-laws, then the friends, then the parents all start saying, you're too young. This will ruin your life. Just one little procedure and it'll all be better. And, of course, we have to ask ourselves how many precious little boys and girls who would have grown up into good, decent citizens have been brutally murdered and put in garbage dumps and dumpsters and sewers. How many children are gone? We know 30 million, maybe 35, maybe 40. Maybe we'll never know.
Let me ask you, I know you feel that if your mother had an abortion that you wouldn't be alive. And you're always thinking in those terms about people. If somebody had an abortion, this life wouldn't exist. I know that you don't believe in sex before marriage. I mean, you could say that if your parents didn't have sex before marriage, you wouldn't have been alive either, but...
Isn't the providence of God an amazing thing?
So you mean you condone sex before marriage if it results in your birth?
No, not at all. It's one of those mysteries. You just look at the grand spectrum of things. God is on his throne. If you look at the genealogy of Christ in the Bible, there are people in his genealogy who... Well, if morals were being obeyed the way they should have been, those people would not be in the genealogy of Christ. And yet, they are part of his lineage. So God can work all things together for his good. Maybe if my mom and dad had just done the honorable thing and that was wait until they got married, they were engaged. What they should have done was just waited until they got married, and then... I would have been here, or someone else like me would have been here. These things are a mystery to us.
You ran away from home when you were 16. Why did you run away from home?
I wanted to leave. I was a rebel. I was obviously not a Christian at the time. I was not brought up in a Christian home. And I was a rebel. I wanted to leave. I quit school and I left.
What did you want to do?
What did I want to do? I was a guitar player and an organ player, and I wanted to play rock and roll.
Who were your influences? What bands did you want to be like?
Oh, good grief. Led Zeppelin, Kiss. Who else was I listening to back then? The Beatles, intensely.
Have you come to think of Led Zeppelin and Kiss as the devil's music now?
Well, I don't know what the devil listens to in hell, but I can assure you the lyrics of those bands, not the music per se, but the lyrics, the message of those bands is definitely devilish, hedonistic, abusive of women. So certainly it's evil, sinister, and some of it I would certainly think is demonically inspired.
Randall Terry, what do you think the next step is in your fight against abortion?
The first step is to keep the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act from passing, which would break the back of the rescue movement. The second step is to keep FOCA, Freedom of Choice Act, from passing, Unfortunately, we're in a very defensive posture right now. But simultaneously with that, Terry, the challenge before us is to raise up men and women whose ethical allegiance is to the Ten Commandments to become the school board officials, the county councilmen, the city assemblymen, the state senators, the federal congressmen and senators. We've got to have a changing of the guard. We've got to get rid of the Ted Kennedys and the Barney Franks and the Dianne Feinsteins and replace them with men and women who fear God, who are wise because they fear God, who honor the Ten Commandments, and who aren't ethical fools. Otherwise, we're never, ever going to win.
You've spoken several times in this interview against homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Have you always spoken out against homosexuality in public forums before, or is it more recently that you've been speaking about homosexuality as well as abortion?
No, I've always spoken out against it in public forums, but a recent addition to my menu is that I've actually mobilized protests against homosexuals in the military. You will recall at the beginning of January that there was a whole bunch of cities around the country that had a Just Say No to Homosexuals in the Military campaign. Well, I was a part of putting that together. And the reason, of course, being is that homosexuality is an abomination. They are recruiters of children. They do not reproduce. So they are forever trying to recruit, especially young children. And it's a criminal behavior that must be stopped. We will not equate their vulgar lifestyle and all of their vulgar sexual practices. I mean, let's remember, this is not two guys holding hands and kissing each other on the cheek. These are acts that are too vulgar to describe. We are not going to put their vulgar lifestyle on par with normalcy, with the family, or with things that are good and pure and upright.
You're very confident that you are carrying out God's word and that other people don't quite get what God really means. Have you had visions of God coming to you and kind of telling you what to do?
No. I just read the Bible. I even though I was trained in a public school, I still understand phonetics. I can still read. And the Ten Commandments are very clear. The book of Deuteronomy, the book of Exodus, the books of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're very, very clear. And what we've got in this day is people who just don't want to read their Bible. Or they want to say that God is tolerance. God accepts all things equally. And that's just not true. God is love. It's amazing that he would send Jesus Christ to die for us and that we could be forgiven of our sins and become Christians and followers of Christ. But he also sends us to hell if we don't believe in Jesus, if we don't follow God, if we disobey his commandments.
So you're not worried about tolerance? 'Cause
intolerance is a beautiful thing.
Intolerance?
Intolerance is a beautiful thing. I mean, let's think about it. Susan B. Anthony was intolerant of only men voting. Martin Luther King Jr. was intolerant of segregation. Lech Walesa was intolerant of communism. George Washington was intolerant of British troops and King George.
I think you're using the word a little differently than
a beautiful thing.
Randall, I think you're using the word a little differently than it's commonly used for.
Well, I make no bones about it. There are people that are politically correct that want to say that the cardinal sin of the hour is intolerance. And I think that's a bunch of junk, and I want people to feel good about intolerance. As long as they're intolerant of something that is evil, not intolerant of, say, a race or a gender.
Randall Terry, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thanks for having me.
Randall Terry is the founder of Operation Rescue and author of the book Why Does a Nice Guy Like Me Keep Getting Thrown in Jail, published by Huntington House Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The anti-abortion group Operation Rescue tried to stop abortions in seven cities last week. Coming up, we talk with the director of a couple of clinics which were targeted. Diane Strauss directs private clinics in Philadelphia and New Jersey. She's led her clinics through many protests in the past few years. Her home has also been picketed by anti-abortion protesters. She'll tell us how she handles attempts to shut down her clinics. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Liz Phair's debut album, Exile in Guyville. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton's nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, appears to be on the fast track to confirmation. In the opening session of her confirmation hearings, the panel praised her record as a civil rights attorney and her 13 years as a federal appeals court judge. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
There was little initial challenge today as senators on the Judiciary Committee read opening statements and began to question the nominee. No serious opposition has surfaced since her appointment, and committee members predict a speedy approval. Only Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter raised concern today about what he called judicial activism, but his Republican colleague Orrin Hatch said her earlier role as an advocate is distinct from her current role as a judge. My approach, she said today, is neither liberal nor conservative. She also warned the committee that she would not answer, forecast, or hint about how she would vote on questions the court may be asked to decide. To do so, she said, would display disdain for the entire judicial process. Chairman of the committee, Senator Joseph Biden, predicts the hearings will conclude within a week. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Also on Capitol Hill, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan told lawmakers today that they must enact a budget that cuts the federal deficit at least $500 billion over the next 5 years, the amount first requested by President Clinton. NPR's John Itstey reports.
Chairman Greenspan rejected suggestions that a $400 billion cut in the deficit might be adequate. And he said if Congress backed away from the president's deficit reduction target, there would be a price to pay in the credit markets, which are expecting a $500 billion package.
I fear that should that expectation be thwarted, that the markets would respond in a negative fashion.
The negative reaction would come in the form of higher long-term interest rates. Greenspan wouldn't speculate on how high they might go, but he was clear that he believes the recent drop in long-term interest rates to their lowest point in several decades is due to the promise of big deficit reduction. Greenspan said the economy is strong enough to absorb $500 billion in tax hikes and spending cuts. He said that for the rest of this year, growth should be near a 3% annual rate, and he said there's little chance of the economy falling back into recession. I'm John Itstey in Washington.
In the continuing fight between Russian President Boris Yeltsin and Russian lawmakers, Parliament has voted to suspend an order to speed up the nation's moves to a free market economy. According to Moscow News reports, the lawmakers have sent the presidential order to the nation's highest court. One government official is quoted as saying the move is part of a bid to stop the sell-off of state-owned enterprises. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 9.5 points to close at 3,544.78 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. According to a new study, unemployment in the most affluent nations of the world may climb to 8.5% this year, just below a post-war record. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says next year the jobless figure could go higher than the present 35 million people looking for jobs. The study blamed a worldwide recession for most of the problem, but also said another major reason for the high jobless figure is discouragement among long-term unemployed whose failure to find work leads to an erosion of skills and then withdrawal from the labor market. After dropping about 1.5 inches since Sunday, floodwaters will likely crest at St. Louis again tonight. Andrea Murray of member station KWMU reports that heavy rain predicted for tonight has local officials concerned.
The Army Corps of Engineers says the flood isn't worsening. Tonight's crest is a typical fluctuation in the course of the 2 or 3 day crest period. But Chief Hydrologist Gary Dyhouse says at a record 47 feet, it could create more problems along the saturated River De Pere, where sandbag walls are exactly that high. Emergency management workers repaired a break there earlier today, but are still concerned about the integrity of local levees. Workers will patrol the area again tonight. The floodwaters will then descend about 2 inches a day through the week. Dyhouse says in a few elevated areas, some residents may be facing cleanup by the end of next week. For National Public Radio, I'm Andrea Murray in St. Louis.
In Atlanta, fire broke out near the press box at the Fulton County Stadium late this afternoon. Fans arriving for a baseball game between the Braves and the St. Louis Cardinals had to be evacuated from the stadium. The fire in the stadium's luxury boxes continued for 25 minutes before firefighters could get close enough to douse water on it. One or two Atlanta firefighters were treated for heat exhaustion. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the first part of our show, we heard from Randall Terry, founder of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue. Last week, the group targeted abortion clinics in seven cities. My guest, Diane Strauss, has defended women's clinics against Operation Rescue and other anti-abortion groups. She directs four women's medical centers. Last week, there were Operation Rescue demonstrations at three of those centers, two in Philadelphia and one in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Her own home was picketed by anti-abortion protesters several years ago. Before Operation Rescue came to Philadelphia, Mayor Ed Rendell made it clear he'd get tough with protesters who broke the law. I asked Strauss how Mayor Rendell and the police in Cherry Hill responded to Operation Rescue.
Well, in the past, some of the leaders of the local anti-abortion movement have sent literature around the country saying, come to Philadelphia. It's a great place to blockade. If you get arrested at all, you will be let go. You won't be fined. Nothing will happen to you. And they'd be allowed to sit there for several hours before an arrest took place. With the new administration, Mayor Rendell said that under no circumstances would he tolerate this and that they would be removed immediately. They had fences around the different centers to prevent the blockaders from getting near the doors. They had a lot of volunteers who kept the doors open, who created corridors for patients. So they just were not able to do any of this blockading. In Cherry Hill, the Cherry Hill police removed the blockaders very quickly the last time they had a blockade, which was over 2 years ago. And they don't get the satisfaction of closing a clinic, and then they went to court and they were fined heavily.
What did you do to prepare your clinics for possible actions?
Well, we certainly beefed up our security, and we worked very closely with the police departments in both Philadelphia and in Cherry Hill. And we were not sure what kind of action they might take. This Operation Rescue came out of what we might call a boot camp in Melbourne, Florida. Some of the leaders had spent 3 months down in Florida training, and it's almost as if they were missionaries out of Waco coming to tell us how to interpret the Bible, and we weren't really sure what they were going to do. Their curriculum in Melbourne has to do with a lot of stalking of individual staff members, and we were concerned that this might be a new shift in policy. And certainly after the murder of Dr. Gunn, we feel that doctors are being targeted. And indeed, they did go out to some of the physicians' homes, and they did circulate wanted or not wanted posters with pictures of the physicians on them. So they did do some degree of stalking, and we were real concerned that this might happen and that our homes would not be safe and that our staff members would not feel safe, nor would their families.
Back in 1989, you personally were targeted. Your home was picketed. What exactly happened to you?
Well, the first time I was picketed, my husband and I were out of town, and when we returned home, my 15-year-old daughter was extremely upset and said that the house had been picketed, and she had taken pictures, she had called the police, she had run to a neighbor, she had called her friends, and there were about 35 people all over the lawn banging on the doors and praying and saying, we're praying for your mother because she kills babies and she's a murderer. And my daughter went out and told them, please get off the property, please leave her alone. She said, my mother isn't home. I don't have anything to do with the Women's Center. I'm 15 years old. I live in this house. Please leave me alone. And they did not leave her alone. So she did call the police. One woman took a one-year-old infant and shook it in my daughter's face and said, your mother tried to kill her a year ago, but I didn't have the abortion. And my daughter just said to this woman, I'm glad you made the choice that was right for you. At which point, my neighbors became extremely outraged that this young teenager who has nothing to do with the issue whatsoever was being targeted and clearly was becoming upset by these people. And the neighbors at one point got extremely irate. When they came to her defense, some of the protesters accused them of not being good Christians. I understand that there was almost a fist fight among some of the neighbors who wanted these people out of the neighborhood. Folks who had little children didn't want them to go by and see gory, dismembered fetus pictures. And how do you explain abortion to a three-year-old who lives in the neighborhood? And what are these people doing there with all these signs? And why are they singing? And why is Amber so upset? So it was very disturbing to my daughter. And the neighbors came out in tremendous support for us.
What impact did this have on you?
Well, I was very, very much angered as a parent. I think we all get very protective of our children. And I was outraged that they would take their disagreement with what I do and foist it onto a young child who had nothing to do with the Women's Center. So I was scared for her.
I think for some doctors and medical workers who have been personally targeted by the anti-abortion movement, some of them have become very scared, intimidated by that tactic, and have chosen to stop performing abortions. I think some doctors who might previously have chosen to perform abortions are avoiding it now because they don't want to be harassed. When you were personally targeted, when your home was picketed, did it go through your mind that maybe you should get out of running these clinics that provide abortions just so you could protect yourself and your family?
Well, that has happened to other staff members, and I think the fact that my daughter was old enough to call the police and protect herself kept me from feeling that way. I do know we've had staff members who had young children who were frightened and felt with a three-year-old that they were very vulnerable. What happened to me was exactly the opposite. I became absolutely outraged that in the United States of America, someone should try to terrorize me out of my job. And I thought, well, maybe I'd want to get another job at some point in my life, but I'll be darned if I'm going to do it because these people frighten me and threaten me to make me quit my job.
Were you ever frightened again after that? Were you targeted again after that?
Well, the house had been picketed several times. They came on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and my husband is Jewish, and he was very distressed as they stood out there with big crosses and said, "Turn to Jesus," and sang "Onward, Christian Soldier" on the lawn and banged on the door. And he felt that was truly an invasion of his privacy. It was a Sunday, late morning, early afternoon, and it was very disturbing. I've also had several verbal threats on my own safety, and it's very disturbing. It's disturbing to be at work and the phones ring, and we are forever getting calls that say we're murderers, we're baby killers, we're going to blow you up, you should all die, you deserve to die, you deserve to be thrown into a pit of fire. And this kind of onslaught hits us daily, and it is distressing. And it's more disgusting because we live in the United States and we shouldn't have to be dealing with this. We're not doing anything illegal, and this is an area that people can do other things if they don't agree with us. They don't have to have abortions. They could educate people. They could do more for unwanted children. There are a lot of things they could do besides try to terrorize people providing medical care.
My guest is Diane Strauss, the director of 4 Women's Medical Centers. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Diane Strauss, directs 4 women's medical centers which perform abortions. 3 of those centers, 2 in Philadelphia and 1 in New Jersey, were targeted last week by Operation Rescue. Now, in Northeast Philadelphia, where you run a clinic, there was a successful attempt, I believe, to use RICO, the anti-racketeering law, to prevent certain protests trying to close down the clinic. How did that work?
Well, we had to show before the federal judge that there was indeed a conspiracy of a number of groups, and that their goal and their stated goal was to close the business of the Northeast Women's Center. And we did show that. They had invaded the clinic. They had injured staff members. They had damaged equipment. They had followed patients home. And they were on videotape saying, "We're going to close you." And under the racketeering statutes, you cannot conspire with groups to do that. And therefore, the judge found in our favor.
And what did that accomplish?
It accomplished an injunction which protects all of us that work there and gives protection to the Northeast Women's Center. And it wound up sending a few people to jail, which we had been not able to do in the criminal courts.
Do you have any friends or colleagues who have given up performing abortions because of fear?
Yes, I do. I know of numerous people who have done that. One was a woman who was a single parent that worked in the center, and the protesters would sometimes show up at her house when her child was coming home from school, and they would call up and say, "We're going to pull your son limb from limb like you do the little fetuses." And because she was a single parent and she couldn't keep an eye on her child, she chose not to work there anymore. And, you know, staff have had their tires slashed. They've had, you know, people follow them, filming them. So for some people, it's a very frightening ordeal to have to put up with this.
What do you tell your colleagues at the centers that you run when that happens?
Well, first, we do as much as we can to protect them. We try to look at all the laws. There are stalking laws now on the books in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania. We look at harassment statutes. And we teach the staff how to document and to take care of themselves so that we can go into court and take proper legal action against this type of it's terrorism. And the goal of it is to frighten somebody out of their job. And that is just absolutely despicable in a civilized society.
Now, there was an action in front of your New Jersey clinic. I think this was it was this past spring, where people basically, where the protesters shackled their necks to cars so that they couldn't be moved. Would you explain what they did?
Yes, it was a very, very cold, snowy day in March, and I think the temperature was about 17 degrees. And one of my staff members looked out the window to see a car up against the door, and when she looked further, there was a car up against our emergency exit door as well. And these were old, dilapidated cars, and she saw legs sticking out from underneath them. And we soon discerned that there were four people who had chained their necks to the underside of the car, and so that we could not remove them. There were a number of picketers out on the sidewalk, and it cost the taxpayers of New Jersey a tremendous amount of money. Not only the taxpayers of Cherry Hill, but we had to call the state police to get the jaws of life to dismantle these cars. We had to have fire engines on hand because one of the people had his neck so close to the gas tank that there was some concern that if they began to saw at the chain around his neck that we could possibly have a fire. And after 4 hours of being out in 17-degree weather underneath cars, these people did also need some medical attention. So it just shows you that these people are not very rational. That's not a rational action. It didn't stop any abortions that day. We had another door through which all our patients came in.
How responsible did you feel for the health and well-being of the protesters?
Well, I told them that they were on private property, that they weren't welcome, and I really suggested strongly that they get a key and unlock themselves and leave. One of their people from the sidewalk came and talked to them and said it's okay with them if they're cold, they could get up and leave, that the movement would not feel that they were wimping out in any way. So they had every opportunity to get up and leave. I felt absolutely no responsibility for someone that does something like that of their own volition.
I know many abortion clinics find it very, very difficult now to find doctors who are willing to perform abortions, and they're finding it even more difficult to find doctors who they really want to work with who can perform abortions. Are you running into that kind of problem?
Certainly. It's a national problem. We have a center in Omaha, Nebraska, where we fly a doctor in from out of state every weekend to perform abortions. And I know we're not alone in doing that. I'm very fortunate to work with very, very dedicated doctors who really believe in what they're doing. They tend to be older, they tend to have seen what happened when abortion was not legal, and they tend to feel very, very strongly about the service they want to provide to women, and I'm very fortunate to be able to work with these people.
Are you afraid to talk even in a situation like this on a radio show, you know, a national radio show, and you know, speak your views and have your name be known by people? In other words, are you afraid that there will be reprisals against you because you're being outspoken now?
Yes, I am. And I know that my name does come up frequently in rallies, and I'm very concerned about that. You know, I go to work to help provide medical care for women, and we provide a wide range of services. We provide gynecology, birth control, teaching birth control devices. We do more in one day to prevent abortions than Randall Terry and Operation Rescue have done from the beginning of Operation Rescue. So it's very ironic that I should be targeted. But yes, it does give me some concern.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Diane Strauss directs women's medical centers in Philadelphia, Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and Omaha, Nebraska. This is Fresh Air. Hearings began today on the appointment of President Clinton's nominee to the Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll have details of what happened on Capitol Hill today in the first of the hearings for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Also, a discussion about Louis Freeh. He is President Clinton's choice to be the new FBI director. The Senate Armed Services Committee holds hearings on the president's directive about homosexuals in the military. The committee chairman, Sam Nunn, says Congress will vote on that issue. I'll talk with a military sociologist about details of the new directive, how much difference it could make for lesbian and gay soldiers. And Don Gagne reports on flood cleanup in Davenport, Iowa.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In interviews, singer-songwriter Liz Phair has said that one of the primary inspirations for her debut collection, Exile in Guyville, was the Rolling Stones' 1972 album, Exile on Main Street. Like the Stones, Phair prides herself on a tough stance and jaundiced attitude toward romance, but rock critic Ken Tucker says she brings her own style to her confessional rock and roll.
You said things I wouldn't say straight.
Phair's Exile in Guyville is ambitious for a debut. It contains a hefty 18 songs, which range from singer-songwriter diary entries to flat-out, spat-out hard rock. For much of its generous length, Phair's Exile is pretty much what you'd expect from a young, upper-middle-class person who takes up a paragraph of her record company bio with details such as the fact that her father is a, quote, renowned neurologist and skin-diving enthusiast, as well as the fact that she was brought up with a serious liberal arts approach to child development. Liz Phair sounds, in short, like a spoiled brat who's decided that the spoiled brat is a neglected figure of celebration in rock and roll. And I'll be darned if she doesn't redeem this notion.
You've been around enough to know that if I want to leave, you better let me go. I take full advantage of every man I meet. I get away almost every day with what the girls call, what the girls call, what the girls call, the girls call.
I like the way in that song Phair's voice floats across the top of one long, sinuous guitar line, and her tone of voice is somewhere between that of a threat and a whispered secret. She's taking us into her confidence, explaining that she can be as much of a creep to men as they've been creeps to her. Fair's best songs are like this, scenes of breakups and arguments filled with small, precise details.
And when I asked for a separate room, it was late at night, and we've been driving since noon. But if I'd known how that would sound to you, I would have stayed in your bed for the rest of my life, just to prove I was right, that it's harder to be friends than lovers, and you shouldn't try to mix the two, 'cause if you do it and you're still unhappy, then you know that the problem is you. And it's true that I stole your lighter, and it's also true that I lost the map. But when you said that I wasn't worth talking to, I had to take your word on that. But if you'd known how that would sound to me, you would have taken it back and boxed it up and buried it in the ground. Boxed it up and buried it in the ground. Boxed it up and buried it in the ground. Burned it up and thrown it away.
There's a thin quality to Exile in Guyville. It ends up making you think that Liz Phair is something of a dabbler, that if this rock thing doesn't work out, she'll take up painting, or maybe just use her trust fund to live in Paris for a while. But there's a core of about four or five songs here that are really first rate, and one in particular, called Flower, that I can't play on the radio, but which is as fine and bold a song I've heard about sexual obsession. If Phair is going to continue to use the Rolling Stones as her model, let's hope that next time out she comes up with her own version of Some Girls and not Goat's Head Soup.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Liz Phair's new album is Exile in Guyville. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Betty Boop and Popeye were Richard Fleischer's playmates when he was growing up. His father was animator Max Fleischer. Richard Fleischer became a film director. One of his best-known movies, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, was produced by his father's rival, Walt Disney. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Richard Fleischer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.